This is a Hubris Mosaic production. All views expressed herein are those of the individuals and do not represent Hubris Mosaic.
Hello, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Matt.
And together we are...
Cousins of Hope!
Cousins of Hope! I was waiting for you to go first.
Oh, well. It works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Positivity, it sees you through everything.
This week's quote comes from author Philip Pullman, and he said, "After nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the things we need most in the world."
Absolutely. Which feeds nicely into this week's theme. It's almost like we pick these things, which is storytelling, or stories in general.
That man doesn't know how to tell a story.
He does. He certainly does. I have to admit, I haven't read... or haven't read it for quite a long time, the His Dark Materials trilogy. I need to go back and reread it because it's sort of faded to the point where all I remember are armoured bears and kids with animals on their shoulders and stuff.
Which
is obviously the very basic level of the storytelling on that one.
No, it's funny because it's been out almost as long. In fact, I think it's been out as long as Harry Potter, hasn't it? But it's...
Yes, and it's done not as well, but it's sort of somehow, I think, is likely to last longer, maybe.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. I do. Mm. I think it's... And I say this as a huge Harry Potter fan. Mm. I think it's more interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think...
Which is not to do down Harry Potter because, you know, before all the Harry Potter fans shout at me, I was there before you lot. A, I'm older than you. B, I found out about it before you did.
You know that they don't shout. They cast Cruciatus curses on you.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Mm. Damn it. But I just think it's doing something slightly more interesting.
Well, it's doing something on a different depth sort of side of things, isn't it? I mean, Harry Potter is your basic... hero's journey, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with the hero's journey. I love Harry Potter, the books. I hate the films because I think that they just missed the point. But anyway, Star Wars is my thing, and that is about as standard a hero's journey as you can possibly get.
Yes,
and the two are basically the same thing on a very basic level. You know, So yeah, but at that same level, I wouldn't turn around and say that Star Wars has the answers to everything in it or asks any particularly deep and interesting questions.
No, Star Wars is really interesting because, and you probably know this better than I do, but George Lucas has talked about the fact that it's sort of heavily influenced by Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Yes, yeah.
And that kind of idea of a monomyth.
Yes.
And the number changes depending on who you talk to, but that idea that there are only a certain number of storytelling routes in the world. What you do with them is kind of what makes it interesting. Mm. But you know, there's the journey, and then there's the hero's quest, which I can't remember if they're the same thing. But you know what I mean. There's about, well, as I say, depending on who you talk to, there's sort of 5 to 7 of them.
Yeah, 7 is the one I've heard quoted most, but then you've done more of that side of it, you know, than I have. We should, of course, say that you are indeed a storyteller in your own right, in that you're in the midst of writing your first book, aren't you?
I am, yeah. Well, yes, I have finished. Well,
you finished it. Excellent.
You never really finish writing anything. Yeah. But it is out. I have sent it off for people.
Oh, cool.
To
excellent.
Look at. But yes, so yeah, and I think everyone has the capacity to tell stories. I don't necessarily agree that everybody has the capacity to write a book. I think that's a different statement, and that's not to say that people can't. People are going, "What do you mean?" What I mean by that is, no one in their right mind would actually set out to write a book because it is, and I've got a fantastic, fantastic George Orwell quote that I will have to dig out for you, which is, oh, here it is. He said, writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle, like a long bout with some painful illness. One would never undertake such a thing if one were not driven on by some demon whom one can neither resist nor understand, which is entirely different, I think, to telling stories, which I think we are absolutely all geared up to.
Yeah, the thing is, I think that there's, you get there's a as Philip Pullman quite rightly said, there's a basic human need to tell people things. I mean, that's why gossip is a thing, you know. I mean, yes. Gossip is nothing but storytelling about things that you've seen recently.
Absolutely.
But you put, you know, a random selection of people around a fire, and unless they find out very quickly that they hate one another, they'll be telling stories within 10 minutes, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it was the way that history and not rules as such, but the kind of the way that sort of society worked was passed on from generation to generation, wasn't it?
There's
a much better way of describing that.
An oral history.
Yes, absolutely. And messages delivered from one community to another via minstrels.
Mm.
And
it's I think you can look at human history, I should say, as on one level an increase in the width and breadth of storytelling ability to get to more people, because you look at the storytellers of prehistory, so 6,000 years plus back to what, 70,000 years or thereabouts, when we started moving out of Africa, and probably even before that, the stories that they had would only reach the people who could hear their voices.
Yes.
And I always, because of the fact I'm a hopeless romantic, I always think it's really poignant to know what those stories would have been, because they have been lost. And there's nothing more poignant than a lost story, I think. But then as you get more and more people, like with Travelling Minstrels, you can get the word out a little bit further, and then you get travelling plays and so on and so forth, and then you get scripts that can be used, and gradually that communication can spread until now you have, you know, movies and films, movies and books and the internet in general, where you can write something and everyone can read it immediately should they wish to, or everyone can see it immediately should they wish to.
Absolutely. And while you were talking, I was just sort of thinking about, obviously there's a storytelling element going on in cave paintings, which again, kind of your point that they would have only been seen sort of locally as such, but actually in our interest in history and archaeology and everything, those stories are kind of being retold in a sense.
It's that sort of fingertip, sort of almost reaching and just about brushing the edge of what the story might have been. I mean, have you seen Chauvert caves down in southern France? Have you seen the pictures from them? They've got sort of lions and bulls and various other bits and bobs across the walls, but basically it was found in the 70s, I want to say, after being closed off for basically 30,000 years, and they're pristine and they're amazing, and they let 7 people in a year, and that's it.
Because
down the road at Lascaux caves, which you used to be able to go to, they let in so many people that unfortunately the cave's ecosystem changed slightly, and mold started growing on these pristine 30,000-year-old cave paintings, and some of them may be beyond restoration. And you just think to yourself, these things are so precious, you know. I'm absolutely fascinated by cave paintings and things like that, because you just think to yourself, did the person who was painting this have any idea that these things would live on even remotely as long as that would, you know, what was their concept of time even? I mean,
absolutely. Completely agree. The other kind of related element, I was thinking that you were going to say one of the reasons they wouldn't let so many people in is because of graffiti. Because I think I've been to other caves, I can't remember where you kind of go along and someone scrawled something on the wall and you sort of think,
I
believe you did that. But at the same time, there are other bits of graffiti that have shown up that are part of, are now sort of kind of almost historical documentation in their own right. Didn't they find a bunch recently somewhere in Kent? And it was they put some conscientious objectors in prison, and they found all their sort of there was sort of graffiti on the prison walls and things, I think.
It rings a bell.
And you can go to the Tower of London as well, and the same thing. You can kind of see little messages sort of marked out into the brickwork, which again, in their own right, are kind of very tiny microcosms of storytelling. Well, yeah, there is a story behind it.
Yeah, I mean they've even got it in the Pyramid of Giza. Above the main chambers, there's a sort of a triple layer roof that they've made out of interlocking stonework. Right. And there are little chambers up there which were never meant to be got into, but because we now have, micro cameras and little robots and things, they've sent robots and then eventually people up there. And these chambers have been unopened for 3,000 or 4,000 years, and all the builders had left their marks there, and completely unknown that they were. So people just wanted to see what the structure was that was holding up the rest of the pyramid above it, because obviously, structurally, that's incredible.
And then
they got there, and it was basically, Dave built this bit,
It's almost compulsive, isn't it? I mean, it's funny, when we moved into our house, it hadn't been done up for a long time, so we sort of stripped everything back and had to replaster. But in the process of stripping back, we found a message from somebody. I can't remember what it was. It was quite funny. It was a bit like, the builder was here sort of thing. Oh, but it just made us chuckle because, it's hidden under sort of 3 or 4 layers of wallpaper.
Yeah.
And again, I love that idea of, as I say, it's a compulsion. And we had extension work done, and we came in one day to discover that one of the guys had, he'd written his name in the wet concrete. And I love the fact that, I mean, obviously you now can't see the concrete, but I quite like the fact that his name is in this concrete under my flooring. And as I say, I know that's not quite telling a story, but it is. But there's a story behind it.
Yeah, and there's a connection, and it makes people wonder. And I mean, I wonder with storytelling if, on a very basic level, I may be going too deep here, I often do, if it's a connection between you and the future. Maybe it's a desire to gain a very minor taste of immortality, almost, isn't it? But
no, I think that's absolutely right. I think that I think there's absolutely something in that. It's that desire to leave. People leave legacies in different ways, and for some people, that legacy is storytelling. Mm. I think it's also for me, it's a desire to feel connected.
Yeah.
So you tell a story, I mean, this whole podcast half the time is just you and me telling stories.
Absolutely. Shouting into the ether, hoping that someone will shout back again.
Yeah, exactly.
Back.
Yes, please. it's that sort of that need to feel connected to each other. Mm. And sometimes, and we've talked about this before, sometimes, when you're having conversations with people and you feel like, I worry sometimes I'm taking over a conversation, and I worry it sort of looks like it's because I must be the center of attention. Mm. Whereas actually it's quite often what I think is going on in my head is you've said something and I've got something to share that's kind of connected to that, and I want to feel that connection with you by telling you my story, so that we can both go, gosh, isn't that interesting, isn't that funny, we've got that thing in common.
Absolutely.
That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it.
Now shut up and listen.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, what was I saying? So I think it's a very simple way of connecting you with other people. I mean, there's nothing lovelier, I don't think, than sort of telling us. Well, there's nothing lovely than telling a story to me and making someone laugh. Actually, that's kind of my favorite thing. I remember working in a new team many, many years ago, and discovering quite early on that I could make a certain person laugh by sort of the stories I was telling. And it's quite addictive, actually. You see, I can see, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a comedian. I should point out, not on purpose anyway. But I don't know if that's what compels comedians. And obviously that is another form of storytelling.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, interesting, isn't it?
I think that, again, this is my own personal preference and stuff, but the comedians who can make their whole set into a giant story of one form or another that it interlinks back to one another, and it is quite you know, although you don't often recognize it until they finish their set, when it all ties up in a big bow and you go,
yes.
Oh, right. Okay. And actually the whole thing has been a journey, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, Eddie Izzard obviously being one of the prime examples of that, you know.
Well, he is a god.
He is, yes. And I just love that when he sort of drops that final line and you go, oh, that's referring back to the first. Oh, right. I see. We've come full circle. Excellent. You know.
Yeah, he's remarkable, isn't he? Because he gives off this impression that it's all very ad libbed, and I'm sure I'm sure there's plenty of that in there. But I think I saw a documentary of him in the past where he sort of talked about like anything, there is a certain amount of scripting that's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the structure is the important thing there, and then the improvisational bit seems to be obviously interacting with the audience, but also there's that sort of thing of selling it, you know, making it live rather than just recited lines, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that must be incredibly difficult after telling the roughly the same joke, you know, 60 times on 60 nights in 60 different places, and you just think to yourself, God, that must be exhausting.
Well, maybe
so
that's why it does it in different languages, you know.
Yeah, maybe, maybe.
Keep it interesting. Who knows? Who knows? But, I guess that's the thing, you can sort of tell, there's so many different ways that you can tell stories, and I mean, for me, I think most of those have come through books and film, but you know, for other people, it's music. And for other people, it'll absolutely be comedy. I mean, that's the beauty of it, isn't it? As I say, I think it's just so kind of built into us. We almost can't help ourselves.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that the thing that grabs me, again, as I say, and this is why I love history, because history is a story, you know, at the end of the day.
Yes.
And it's a story that you're never entirely sure you've got right. And I think that's the thing that, you know, again, you're touching a moment that, angry baby.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. I can tell you a story about an angry baby, if you like.
I'm sure you can tell me many.
I've got sound effects.
Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm that prepared. So instead of angry babies, though, I think I might gibber on about one of my favourite stories of all time, which is Robin Hood.
Ah, yes. Well, yes. And that's a fabulous example of everything that we've just been talking about in terms of oral history and how it's changed over, centuries. But carry on.
Yeah, no, about...
this was your story, not mine.
No, that's okay. 900-ish years. I believe the first line ever written, or that we still have, that was ever written about Robin Hood was Robin Hood in Barnsley Stood.
Ah.
Which is weird, because I didn't think he came from Barnsley, but never mind.
No, but that's I've been reading a really good book called I think it's called The Secret Library, which is all about books that some of them are about books that you might know about, but there's sort of unexpected thing that you may not have known about it. Some of it's about authors that were kind of ridiculously famous in their day and then sort of disappeared, and in there it talks about Robin Hood, and that's kind of one of the big aspects of what he talks about, is that actually they're very early very early Robin Hood tales. He is as much from Yorkshire as he is from Nottinghamshire.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, the other thing is that obviously the original stories themselves were sort of told in oral form and also in play form, so they were part, and Robin Hood was actually, as far as anyone can tell, because it's obviously very difficult to track, sort of came from Tales of the Green Man.
Yes.
Who's the sort of the spirit of the forest and so on and so forth. And, you know, is generally mischievous and things, and probably has links back to Loki and things like that if you go far enough back into Norse mythology and stuff. I love how something that may have been a guy, probably wasn't, but may have been a guy, has somehow sort of transcended time and turned into a completely different story that now everybody knows, but everybody knows a different version of.
I mean, yes,
even in our lifetime, we've had
don't even bring them up. I'm sorry.
No?
Are you gonna drop the K-bomb on me?
The K-bomb.
Kevin.
Oh, I see. No, I wasn't. I was just going to say we've had loads of versions of it, including Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves by Kevin Costner, with his amazing British accent. I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that just keeps being retold, you know.
Yes, yeah, because there's always, and it's one of those ones that keeps being retold, and when it's done cleverly, kind of is able to sort of take, is able to say something about the time in which it's being told.
Yeah, absolutely.
I used to know a lot more than I do now, because I actually did a Robin Hood module at university.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was very, very cool, and I can't remember very much about it other than the fact that I discovered that there's an American book that was written. It's all told from Maid Marian's point of view.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes, and I've got a funny feeling that Robin Hood might have been gay in it.
Awesome.
We are talking a very, very long time, but as I say, it was kind of interesting because.
But that makes sense because, you know, living in the woods with a load of men, nothing else to do.
Yes. You know, yeah.
Well. Why not? It's just, you know.
I could be wrong about that, but I guess it goes back to Joseph Campbell's point about this monomyth. You can take the monomyth and then you can kind of, you can adapt it and play with it. And, you know, George Lucas does that very thing with Star Wars.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's playing with elements of it. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, I think that the current version of Robin Hood, that I think we mentioned this on the Minotaur's Head a couple of weeks or months back, is currently being prepped, which is going to star Margot Robbie. And it's going to be called Marion. And apparently the idea is that he dies very early in the film.
Yeah.
And she then takes up the bow, basically. And
not really a Robin Hood film, then, is it?
Not really, but it is a version of Robin Hood in some way, shape, or form. I mean, you could argue that, Robin and Marion, which is my favourite Robin Hood movie.
That's the Sean Connery one, isn't
it? That's the Sean Connery one.
And Audrey Hepburn.
Yes, and it's just... it's a stunning film.
Yeah.
And it's not really about Robin Hood.
No, and I'm being facetious.
But it's that one is brilliant. And again, because of the fact that they take the bits that you know.
Yes.
And then twist them into complete and total poignancy.
Well, I think there's also another point there, particularly with the Margot Robbie one, which is about actually telling who, and you kind of said it about history, and you don't necessarily always know everything that you're trying to tell, but it's also who gets to tell it. Mm. So, you know, typically stories, certainly in kind of English literature, the English literature world, the canon as such has been kind of dictated to largely by white men, telling you that you should read other white men. And there's, this is an argument that bubbles, it keeps bubbling away, and it's problematic, and, you know, it's ridiculous because there are plenty of fascinating storytellers who are not white and male, which is not to say that there are not interesting white male writers, but it needs to be broadened that. And I think there's a very interesting trend, which makes it sound a little bit trite, and I don't mean to, but Hollywood particularly has just woken up to the fact that women are paying customers too.
Yes, they exist.
Yes, and not only that, but they were actually involved in kind of important things throughout history. And I will say up front, I haven't seen it. I very much want to. But Hidden Figures is a classic example of that.
Yes, I haven't seen that one yet either. It's on my list.
But... Yeah, me too. And, you know, it's a classic example of, oh, wait, there were some women involved. Maybe we could tell that story.
Yes.
And that's happening a lot at the moment, and which is good. You know, and that's something I'm quite interested in the stories that I'm kind of trying to tell trying to find. I mean, I think most writers are. They're trying to find fragments of stories that either haven't been told or where there are gaps. Have you ever read Pat Barker? Oh, for goodness sake, Lisa. It's one of my favourite books, and I can't remember the name of it. Oh, this is embarrassing. Pat Barker, she wrote, it was, I think it's Regeneration is the one I'm thinking of. There were three books. They were all about the First World War.
Oh, right. Okay. No, I haven't read them then.
And Regeneration is about the doctor who treats Siegfried Sassoon. And I don't know how much you know of this story, but Sassoon was in the army and he was given a medal for bravery. I think he threw it away He wrote a piece that was published, basically speaking out against the war. He was never a conscientious objector, but he, because, you know, obviously because it had been going on for such a long time and he had seen so many people killed, questions were kind of arising in his head as to what they were all doing out there. And I apologize for the vagueness of this bit, but basically the short version of this, he was vouched for by Robert Graves, and he was sent to a hospital in Scotland for where Wilfred Owen was there, suffering very badly from shell shock. So regeneration is about the relationship between Siegfried Sassoon and his doctor. And basically, this is a very long-winded, waffly way of getting to Parker, this is rubbish storytelling. I can't apologize enough. But basically, she was interviewed and by Foyles, the bookshop, and they asked her. Both her grandfather and her stepfather were in the First World War, and she was asked, "Did their experiences inform your writing?" And this is the point I'm trying to get to. And she basically was saying that her grandfather was sort of horribly wounded in a bayonet attack, and her stepfather had been gassed and was left disabled and couldn't work. And she basically says, "So there were wounds and there was silence, and that silence invited imaginative exploration." And I think that's, to get back to my original point, a lot of writers are looking for those gaps in the silence and trying to fill those gaps with stories, basically.
But interestingly, I think it's interesting how sometimes the silences within stories that have been told are actually the bits that make your imagination pop even more.
Yes, which is, absolutely.
Because you fill them yourself, and that's always, if the writer can, or the storyteller can kind of guide you to let your imagination fill that gap in the way that they want.
Yes.
In a way that's complementary to the story they're saying, maybe, or telling.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's powerful.
Did you see the piece? There's a piece that was in The Guardian, I think it was last year. Last year, basically, there's two scientists have been kind of looking into this to do with whether reading, people who read a lot, whether that they have greater empathy for others. And they basically, the upshot of it was, yes. The upshot was yes.
No,
they basically, the upshot was that their research showed that if you read a lot of literary fiction, you tended, based on the tests they did, which I think were fairly narrow, yes, you would have more empathy towards others than, say, if you read genre fiction, which I think they've been doing this study over a few years, and there was a piece actually about 3 years before the one I read last year, and somebody sort of said, are they just slamming genre fiction? And they're not. It's the gaps that you're talking about. I think that the difference between literary fiction and genre fiction, and this is a sweeping statement, so it's it's not, before anyone shouts at me, very, very generally, broadly speaking, literary fiction tends to leave you those gaps to fill, to kind of, and I think that's where that it forces you to think, how would I respond in that situation? My God, that must have been awful or funny or whatever for that person. Whereas genre fiction is, for want of a better term, is more entertainment, which is not to say that literary fictionism. I love both very much. It's doing something different.
Yeah.
And it's just bringing you along for the ride, whereas I think literary fiction at its best is making you work harder, which is where I think that kind of empathy thing comes in.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably quite true. And I think that that's unfortunately why a lot of sort of literary works are often disparaged by people who sort of go, well, I don't like that, it's not something I can really read. And you think, and it's quite often the case of, it's not easy, it's not necessarily fun to read to begin with. It takes time, it takes effort, and it's
some of it's just,
some of it is just boring. You're like, I can't read about this bloody moor anymore.
No, exactly. I'm a great believer. I used to be I used to be very anal about finishing any book that I started, and quite just realized one day a few years ago that actually, do you know what? Life's too short. There are too many books out there that I desperately want to read. Why am I killing myself over this? And and when I stop, there is always that kind of twinge of, oh, I failed, but actually, you know, it's just too many books to read.
Yeah, absolutely. I've tried Moby Dick about four times now, and I'm still only 100 pages in. You know, and I just
some things, and actually that's a really interesting point, because I think I've said this before in another episode, I can't read The Hobbit. I physically cannot sit down and read The Hobbit. I cannot get past that first chapter. But if you sat down and read it to me, or as was kind of in my childhood, my dad sits down and reads it to me, or I watch a film of it, although I don't love the films, but that's another rabbit hole. I could sit there and I would, it's one of my favorite stories. It's fascinating. I've always found that really interesting, that I cannot read that book, but it is one of my favorite stories.
Absolutely. No, that is odd.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, I dearly love Lord of the Rings in both film and book.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny
that you've never mentioned it.
Really? Oh, okay. Maybe I should do. You know, and I think that The Hobbit is sort of in there with that. But I think that the thing with Lord of the Rings is that it does give you. I mean, the Lord of the Rings is very much like it's very much informed by. Oral histories or the sagas from Norse mythology, so a lot of people say, oh, it's a bit dry when you're reading it, and you're like, yeah, well, it's not really meant to be entertainment, as you so rightly said earlier. It's not really an entertainment book. It's been the story itself is entertaining, but it's written in a way that's meant to evoke a different style of writing, a different way of thinking and things like that. I mean, I've got a couple of lines here from my favorite thing, which is called the Song of Durin, which is something that Gimli just breaks out into. The book, if they made the films just like the books, most of it would be singing.
Yes, that is very true.
And I'm not going to sing this because I don't know the tune. So I'll just read it instead. But there's basically this is him talking about the sort of the founder of the dwarven race. It goes a little like this. The world was fair, the mountains tall in elder days before the fall of mighty kings in Nargothrond and Gondolin, who now beyond the western seas have passed away. The world was fair in Durin's day. And that just makes makes the hair on my neck stand on end. I'm like, I want to know what he's talking about. I don't know what it is. But and it's just...
You're going to get a phone call from Audible if you're not careful. That was very good.
Thank you. That was very kind of you.
And depending on copyright issues, I'll see if I can dig out the whole see if we can put the whole thing on the Facebook page.
Oh, that would be cool. Yes. Well, yeah. I think there's fair usage, isn't there? But yeah, it's
ways and means around it. Yeah, I will look into it because it's very lovely.
Oh, thank you. But yeah, no, I mean, it's stuff like that where and that's what I love about Lord of the Rings is the hints of the stuff that came before.
Yes.
That sound so high and romantic and sort of. Just different, you know, I suppose, and it's that to me is always a big bit in storytelling, and this is why I quite like sort of post-apocalyptic fiction and things like that, is the feeling of something that has gone before that has now fallen into disrepair, or we're now beyond that point. It's the sort of thing that unfortunately people play on all the time in the political world of, oh, wasn't world better at this point?
And you're like,
well, no, it wasn't, but
you
know, I still love it in fiction, and I think that that's where it works in a brilliant way, and that's what Lord of the Rings is a sort of an ode to an England that never really existed, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, it still, you know, makes my blood thrill, you know, to read it, and it sort of makes me sort of chills and tingles and things like that. It's quite cool. But you know,
yeah, well, yeah. I think, and kind of what you're referring to there is kind of some of it is the iceberg theory of storytelling, in which that you only ever see when you're kind of reading a book or watching the film, a really good one.
Yes.
You're only ever seeing the tip of the iceberg, and
absolutely.
And what's gone on underneath it is sort of a huge amount of, I mean, it depends on the subject matter, but you know, potentially a huge amount of research, or certainly a huge amount of thought,
will
have gone into character development and histories and things that, you know, I have it in what I've written. There are things that I know about my characters that chances are, nobody else will ever know or guess. Mm. And that's okay, because hopefully the aim is to be, is to, for, that the reader will have a richer experience with that character because you've taken the time to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's for that, for the sort of the more modern form of storytelling, which is very dissimilar to Lord of the Rings and very dissimilar to the sagas, where it's all very much this person stands up and he is this, he is or she is a personification of this ideal.
Yeah.
For real people and real stories in real life, you know, the more sort of naturalistic form of storytelling, you never know everything about somebody. And you know, and that's the thing that I think is great about modern storytelling, is that, you know, you get that, and you get that sort of feeling of meeting a person rather than being shown something that looks a bit like a person.
Yes, so that's the classic thing you always get told when you're studying writing is show, don't tell.
Yes, absolutely.
Occasionally, you can tell, but you don't want to be telling all the time.
No,
The point. But Graham Greene was quite interesting writer, because he kind of wrote two different types of book. He had his sort of, again, for want of a better word, serious books, but then he had what he termed his entertainments. Mm. To go back to the kind of the point about the literary versus genre. Mm. And they were his kind of, they tended to be his thrillers, and I think they were the things he probably, chances are he probably made his money off of, if he made any at all, being a writer. But so he's got books that really sort of think very deeply about things, and then there's things like The Power and the Glory and The End of the Affair, and then I'm trying to think of his entertainments are more say the thrillers and like things like actually I can't think of one. This is not going well. Anyway,
that's okay. Yeah, but no, I think that it's true. It's, you know, at the end of the day, there's space for all stories, and I love the fact that there are, you know, life is basically the story we tell ourselves. If you want to get deep and meaningful on a brain level, there's increasingly within sort of neurobiology and neuroscience, they are increasingly saying that actually the bit of you that you think of as you. Yeah. So the bit where you go, this is me, you know, which never seems to inhabit anywhere, which is always the bit that goes, makes me go, because do you live in your brain?
Oh, don't.
Yeah. And you go, what is me? Anyway, they're saying that more and more, they're sort of saying that actually the experience of the self is actually kind of a story that's told to you by lots of different subroutines in your brain.
Right.
That then form a model of the world around you and show it to you. But it still doesn't explain what the you is that it's being shown to.
That makes me feel like I am actually in the Matrix.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's mad.
It is mad, isn't it? And you just think to yourself, wow. Because even taking that aside and just looking at it from a psychological point of view, we are who we tell ourselves we are, rather than what we actually are. Unless you're, you know, a grandmaster Buddhist monk who has spent their time, reducing that sort of part of yourself that tells you the story just to experience the world as it is rather than as you think it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? And but again, we are the product of our own stories.
Yes. And you're making me think of kind of a really interesting point there is this sort of idea of who you are and who you're connected to. Mm. But also, and I say this having seen Ghost in the Shell last night, is what happens when you tell a story that you feel so connected to, and so many people feel so connected to, and you tell it differently.
Yes.
Discuss.
Yeah. Well, I already have in my Ghost in the Shell review, which you can find. Nice bit of cross-pollination there. I like it. Well done.
Yeah, give your website a plug.
Well, I'm on WordPress at moonvieswithmoon.wordpress.com. You can find it's also posted up on hubrismosaic.co.uk as well. I wasn't massively impressed with it, unfortunately, because it's
I have never seen the anime movie, and I haven't read the graphic novel either. And I went with a person who has seen and read both adores them. And as a consequence, I didn't. It was all right. I didn't love it or hate it, to be honest with you. I just kind of thought, it's all right.
Yeah.
but I kind of recognize because there will be films and that my equivalent where they will have kind of messed with it so greatly that you just think, what?
Yeah. I mean, I have seen the anime only once, mind you, and I've never been a major anime fan most of the time anyway. It doesn't seem to grab my attention for some reason or another. And I have been told off by the people on the Minotaur's head on a regular basis that I'm a heathen for not doing so. But
it feels like a little bit of a gap. But
well, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So you're allowed gaps. It's fine.
I think so. But yeah, I mean, as I said in my review, the original anime has, or the original manga, I assume, as well, has all these questions about who are you and what consciousness is and where the line is drawn between man and machine and you know, where is there that line and can you still retain yourself and things like that. Whereas the movie is basically like, there's a brain in a machine which we'll call a ghost and the machine's the shell. So that's why it's called
cunning.
Ghost in the shell. And you're like, it's just, oh, no.
But it's even simpler. It goes even more, it's even simpler than that in that, you know, from what I understand, the basic story is so different that she is not, you know, how she ends up being where she is in the film is not where she comes from in the anime and the graphic novel, and that can be interesting. And I think your review absolutely was spot on where you were saying that, you know, that's okay if you've got something new to say about a subject or a theme or you know, I think, again, we've talked about the female Ghostbusters before. That was interesting because, not because it had anything particularly new to say, but it was a different slant, you could tell that it loved the original source material and kind of took care of it. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that the people involved in Ghost of Shell didn't love the source material. I suspect they probably did. Mm. It's just, in that instance, when you are going to take on such big themes, and with something so well known by, you know, presumably the group of people you want to be coming to see your film, that you would sort of, I think it's okay to play with things, and that's how art develops and expands, and you know, art responds to other art, but it's if it's not doing, and it's like you said, it just ends up feels derivative in this particular case.
Yeah.
It's not the only one.
No,
it's just that
not.
I happened to see it yesterday.
Yeah, it is a real pity because, you know, it could be something that really opens people's eyes to something brand new, like The Matrix did, which obviously has come from the original Ghost in the Shell. So, you know, it's kind of
absolutely
come full circle. And it's that sort of thing of different stories telling different things. And then you go and go, we'll make this one. But unfortunately, it's been made after, even though it came before, it's been made after the things that have then riffed on it even better than, or not better, but in a different way.
I have a similar problem with films that just are remakes again, just for the sake of remakes,
brand recognition.
Absolutely. And it's like, why did you bother?
Pretty much. And I, you know, it's like when people say to me things like, all remakes are bad. And I'm like, well, not necessarily. I think that there are films which can be remade if the original film wasn't all that great to start with but had an interesting idea behind it.
Yes, that's true.
So I'm now completely blanked on any of them that I usually
it's always, oh, good, it's catching. I think if you are going to remake a really excellent film, you definitely have to have something.
You need to be on point.
That you feel you can add to that, to its canon, I guess.
Or in some way adapt it to make it new and interesting. But again, as you say, reverent to the original in some way, shape, or form. And it's an odd one, really, isn't it? But if somebody said, right, we're rebooting Transformers right now and we're going to do something completely different with it and go back to the idea of robots and so on and so forth, I'd be like, okay, fair enough. I'd wince slightly because I feel like the Transformers movies are generally awful. But,
well, don't worry, because Michael Bay's making a new one, and I saw the trailer last night, Hopkins is in it.
I know, it's terrifying, and it will have King Arthur in it too, and Churchill.
Good grief!
And don't worry, once that one's finished, they've got another 14 planned.
You are joking.
I am not kidding.
Oh man.
Yeah,
Do you
although
think
apparently,
Anthony Hopkins was just bored?
I think he was probably offered a gigantic check for
Oh
very
yeah,
little, for
of
a very
course.
little amount of time on set.
Yes, I imagine
So,
so.
you know, and he just sort of turned up, said his lines, said thank you very much, and left.
Yeah, and why wouldn't you? I
No,
mean, I guess
exactly.
that's the
I
thing.
don't hold that against anyone, but I do
No.
think that those movies particularly have become the sort of, you know, the embodiment of everything that I find wrong with cinema at the
Well,
moment, which is, you know.
and I think Marvel is wobbling badly.
It can be. I think I don't know. I would agree and disagree because I think it's now got to the tipping point where it's got as many good films as it's got slightly less good films.
Oh yeah.
And they sort of balance one another out. But I agree, yeah, the last few haven't been amazing, amazing.
Yeah, there was a really there was a, did you see the hilarious quote from the one of the execs at Marvel who was not the from the film side but from the graphic novel side who's complaining that basically readership numbers are falling
Oh, yes,
because people don't want diversity, which is relevant to my point or to our point about storytelling and having something new to say. I'm sorry, but they took Iron Man. They made her a black lady and called her Ironheart. It's like maybe you need to look at your storytelling
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
rather than, oh, we'll just give her, well, a different gender, a different color, a different face.
Yeah.
That's not your problem, mate.
No, absolutely. And I mean, the thing is that comic books, because they've got such a long history, and there's a whole sort of thing about them being the modern mythology and things like, you know, Batman and Superman are just the monomyth continued, and Spider-Man and things like that, and, you know, Wonder Woman
Yes.
are kind of the four biggest, like, recognizable heroic names of the moment and stuff. But
Yes.
that's, yeah, entirely separate thing. We won't go into that because we'll be here forever. Because I do love
Yes.
that side of things. But yeah, no,
Well,
the problem
we can come
with
back to it another day.
The problem with comic books is the fact that they've had so much history for so long. Most of them are, you know, somewhere. I mean, Batman and Superman are upwards of 75 now,
Yes. They're
and
looking good for it, but
yeah,
well.
they're looking pretty good. But you know, and Marvel, most of Marvel's things are from the early to mid 60s,
Yes.
and later. So they're sort of coming up on their 60, 70th anniversaries and stuff. And you know, so it's, yeah, it's quite, they've got a history of doing all sorts of crazy things several times over. I mean, everyone in comics has died and come back.
Yes.
That's the thing. But again, it's that sort of thing of taking the sections of it that you go, that was amazing, that run was amazing by
Yes,
such
yeah.
and such, and this run was amazing. And in between times, it's just a soap opera with capes and tights, which I know
Yeah.
many people will shout at me for.
Ah, well, no, but that's okay. I soap opera. Soap opera has its place in storytelling. I mean,
This is true.
I am not averse to watching a bit of EastEnders. I don't watch it. Did you just suck the air in between your teeth at me?
I did.
Ugh. I used to watch it religiously. I don't anymore. I just it's it, I'm now at the point where I can just dip in and out occasionally and go, oh, look, those people are all still there, and oh, look, you're all still miserable. But it has its place. It absolutely has
No,
its place.
absolutely.
That you know, there are people kind of enjoy watching it. And I think, you know, to go back to the Marvel point and the diversity thing, I mean, it's just a ridiculous statement on so many
Well, yeah,
levels. But
completely.
you only have to point to the popularity of manga to kind of just punch a massive hole. I mean, as I say, there are many holes you could punch in the argument, but that for me is kind of one of the biggest.
As far as I can tell, the argument is mainly whole.
Yes.
So,
Well, I think it's like panic, isn't it? It's like, oh, look, our figures are dropping, and oh, whoa, what can we blame? Oh, let's not blame
absolutely.
ourselves. Let's blame the people don't want to read diversity. Are you? I mean, which goes back to my point before about the English literature canon being kind of set up by white men. I mean, there is still a huge problem in not all universities, but in universities with certain male professors who will not that they will not diversify. Be that female writers, be that writers from different countries, which is so sad because there are, you know, there are beautiful, interesting, fascinating stories to come. Coming out of cultures all over the world, and I know that's a really obvious statement.
Well, yeah, but again, I think that it's only recently that people have started to be
I don't
aware
know why
of separate, you know, mythologies and things like that. I say recently, in the last 30, 40 years, it's become easier for these sort of things to travel around in place. But to get back to our earlier point, but yeah.
But it's really interesting. Sorry, I just probably cut you up. But it's really interesting when you look around the world, and I yes, everyone's kind of got, but those myths, the mythology, the kernel at the heart of those mythologies is pretty much the same no matter which culture you go around. So, which again, this kind of idea of it being a compulsion and we the sort of necessity to tell each other stories.
Well, we come back round to Carl Jung, who seemed to think that archetypes were true world over, but he was also slightly mad. So, you know,
all the best people are.
Well, yeah, but yeah, no, I think that sort of brings us back round to our original point quite nicely. So I think that maybe we will wrap up there.
Absolutely.
But I don't have I don't know, who would you say is your sort of storytelling hero for the week? I think I would probably vote for Ursula Le Guin, because she is amazing on many, many levels and a great advocate for storytelling in general.
I don't think I can choose. I have too many. There are too many storytellers out. Maybe I'll go for Joseph Campbell, just because of I think he's got interesting. He had very interesting things to say about myth and mythology and that sort of thing. I do have a really lovely, vaguely related news story, which you may have seen.
Oh, Jen's just told me her favourite storyteller is John Lasseter, who's
very
the head,
good.
Head of Pixar.
Oh, well, yes, that's a very good point. In fact, yes, and I didn't even get onto Pixar, and I had a whole bunch of things in my head about Pixar, but never mind. No, good shout, Jen. And for anybody, sorry, briefly on that front, anybody who's interested in writing, Pixar produced their 22 rules for storytelling, which are wonderful. I will dig that out and stick that on the Facebook page as well. But my news story is, you may have seen it was earlier in the week, about the tiny little manuscript book that was found, that popped up on Antiques Roadshow.
Oh, yes.
Do you know about this? This is the little notebook that was 17th century notebook that was written by a scholar when Shakespeare was alive. And they think it's kind of commentary on Shakespeare, because they can see phrases, and I think they can see his name, but they can certainly see phrases that they recognise as relating to, because they can't, I think it's going to take them a while to presumably to kind of, I think it's a bit of a scrawl, for want of a better word, but they can see phrases that kind of relate back to Shakespeare's plays, and so there's and it's worth £30,000, and it basically somebody and. As is always the best way on Antiques Roadshow, is just somebody going, oh yeah, we found it in our attic.
Yes, yeah.
And it's been in their family for generations. I mean, it's ridiculous. So that's my vaguely related to storytelling, happy-ish news story.
Absolutely. No,
for the person who's just discovered they own a £30,000 tiny manuscript.
Absolutely. And I always like those stories of, where did you find this? And you see the look of stunned silence on the guy's face going, ah.
Yes, I think it was kept in a box, actually. It's in pretty good nick for something that's, what, 400 years old?
Yeah, it's just...
I can't count. Anyway, on that note.
Yeah, on that note, absolutely. We'll come to a close on that. So it's goodbye from me.
And bye-bye from me.
And we hope you join us next time on Cousins of Hope.
See ya.
For more Mosaic content, please visit us at facebook.com/hubrismosaic.